right where you belong. This is CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
Welcome to Groundswell Radio on CKUW in Winnipeg. Today, I wanted to present another composer portrait in our series called Canadian Music 101. The documentaries I'm presenting on Groundswell's Canadian Composers 101 series were commissioned by the Center Discs label for an initiative called the Canadian Composer Portraits. Now, as many of you know, these documentaries highlight a generation of professional Canadian composers that were important to the development of Canadian music in the 20th century. Now, who decides who is important is a topic of debate, of course, but suffice it to say, this documentary series offers us a glimpse into that history and illustrates a commitment to Canadian music that is both admirable and, nowadays, quite rare. So here is the radio documentary feature on the Toronto-born composer Cyril Irving Glick.
I believe that a composition grows like a tree or a flower, that it has to have a certain inevitability to it, and it has to blossom.
I'm Cyril Irving Glick, a composer, producer, conductor, painter, something like that.
He had two styles, the Jewish one, and it developed, and it had a great energy.
My name is Dorothy Sandler Glick.
The other, more so-called classical, I think for years he struggled trying to find his own voice.
When Glick chose music as his path, it was still expected of a young composer that he give up any parochial past in favor of a more universal voice. For years, that expectation tormented the young composer.
And for me, it's been a very painful struggle to learn to speak my own language, sacrificing all kinds of things in order to get personal clarity, and taking my time so that if there is such a thing as maturity, it will come on me in the right way.
He wanted to sing from his heart. And all around him, they were going into serial, into this kind of mathematical music, and he just couldn't, in his heart, do this. And it was giving him a lot of trouble. And he was bearing the criticisms of a lot of people.
His search for his own voice was at times agonizing, but the struggle carried him full circle. Eventually, he said, I found out that my roots as a Jew were deeper than my desire to be a composer in the international sense. Glick found the universal in the particular, a particular as close to home as his own name.
Since my birth, in my family, I was always known as Srol, Yisrael, Yisrolical. Any friend who ever came into my home always called me Srol. Irving was left for school. But when I started writing music, very early in my career, I was always signing my music Cyril Irving Glick, because I wanted the name Yisrael, Cyril, to be connected with my music. It was very important for me that he who wrestled with God was part of my music, because I do feel that I struggle in my music to make a statement which is personal and profound, even if it's joyous.
Thank you.
my whole world comes from the background that I grew up with. I grew up in a labor Zionist youth organization in which we sang hundreds of Hasidic and Yiddish and Israeli melodies. I danced my heart and soul out to the Hora and to other dances.
The Toronto of Cyril Irving Glick's youth was full of music. Klezmer and Hasidic songs and dances, the liturgy of the Palmerston Street Shul where his father was cantor, and the smells and sounds of the Kensington Market. Popular and classical music was in the air. Cyril's older brother Norman was a clarinetist. Norman introduced Cyril to a whole new world of music: Al Jolson, Benny Goodman, Chopin, Puccini.
Well, my father was a cantor.
Cyril's older brother, Norman.
And he was able to put heart into his singing, and he was somewhat of a prodigy as a young man. At 12, his brother was carting him around all over Bessarabia and what is now Romania to sing.
My father was a cantor. I grew up as a child wanting to be a cantor.
They landed in Canada in 1923. My father was cordially welcomed into the community as a cantor because he was at his peak. They carried him around from synagogue to synagogue, and they anteed up for him, and he was able to get a decent place to live and get started, and he got a job as a watchmaker and ultimately opened his own jewelry store on Dundas near Bathurst Street in Toronto, and made a name for himself in the city. He was certainly no People's Credit Jewelers, but he tried to emulate their success.
I was in my father's choir when I was 12 years old. And we were at a Rosh Hashanah service. And I was watching my father sing a particular solo. And I was looking around at the congregation. And there were tears in everybody's eyes. And the music was so moving and so absorbing that became the definition, the color of what I wanted music to be.
Music in the family. His father a lot. His brother was a clarinetist, very talented clarinetist. As a matter of fact, I think he could have become a top professional.
Dorothy Sandler was 14 years old and studying piano when she first met Cyril. It would be a few years before they began going out together. Several more years would pass before they were married.
They played a lot of records in the house, and Cyril was very enthusiastic, very moved, and especially by Chopin. So I think the family actually nicknamed him Chopin at a certain point, because he just loved that kind of romantic music.
Now, Sproul was finishing school. And Sproul made up his mind at 15 that he wants to become a composer.
I just felt irresistibly drawn towards music when I was 15 years old. I, with all kinds of nerve, we have a word for it, it's called chutzpah, decided that I was going to spend my life as a composer, but I hadn't really written anything to that date and didn't even perform an instrument.
He had no musical background except singing my father's choir on the high holidays, and he enjoyed that. They never had any music. Everything was memorized, and everything, even the four-part harmony was memorized with people who've done it for years. And so he decided it's fashionable to become a composer. I mean, you know, when you say you want to become a composer, everybody, you know, looks at you, you know. Of course, my mother and father understood how you're going to make money. So he announced to me that he wants to become a composer. He's 15. He wants to become a composer. He's not a bad student in high school. And he decides that that's what he wants to do. So I said, well, I said, the first thing you need to do, I said, you need to get a piano teacher.
First thing I had to do in order to be a composer was to learn how to play the piano. So I started taking piano lessons at age 15.
So as we met, I would say, well, how are you doing? He said, well, I'm going to be a composer. Great. Then finally he entered university. He went into music education. So disappointed in that first year. And he said, oh, I'm a little disillusioned. I said, no, you have to keep on with composing. I was a bully. I have no idea why I was so insistent, because we still weren't really going out. We were just good friends.
He says, I'm going to do it. And he made up his mind, and he graduated high school, and he fought his way into the music diploma course at the University of Toronto, passed it, slugged it, broke his neck, studied with John Weinzweig, got his master's degree. Miracle. Miracle after miracle.
When I went into the Faculty of Music, I really didn't have the background. I was not an instrumentalist. I had never studied harmony. And I'd like to mention Dr. Richard Johnston. And he really let me in on blind faith, because I wanted so badly to be a composer, and he knew it. And so he let me in on the proviso that I could come into the university, provided by the next December I had passed my grade 3 harmony and I was going to catch up. And in fact, when I entered that class at the University of Toronto at age 17, I was at the very bottom of the class. And by the time I finished the year, I was maybe halfway through it. The next year I transferred to a full-time composition course, and I never looked back. I had many composers who I learned a great deal from, not the least John Weinzweig, who for 5 years pushed me, pulled me, coaxed me, and taught me harmony, form, analysis, orchestration. He gave me a sound craft for which to begin as a composer.
Sproul's generous recollection of his time with Weinzweig masks a troubled relationship.
Weinzweig couldn't reconcile himself to his pupil's conservative musical instincts. And so it was a great relief when Sroll discovered a more kindred musical soul in the Czech-born composer Oscar Moravec.
Weinzweig was a very tough guy for him. In fact, if I could say anybody almost deterred him from music itself, it could have been Weinzweig. Moravec, on the other hand, was a great teacher for him. He supported him, he was firm, you know, directed him, and he had obligations, certain studies to complete. Beckwith, I think he liked a lot. And those were the three main here in Toronto that I seem to recall, although he had relationships with other composers and other teachers. But Weinzweig was really difficult for him, because if you have a certain style and you believe in a certain way of expressing yourself, and here is this young kid who is saying, no, I'm not accepting that. It just doesn't fit well with me. I can't abide what you're trying to push me into. And he got through it, but it was not easy. And I would say that it was Moravec who really encouraged him and inspired him. But definitely was those the conflict of music and character.
While John Weinzweig was a 12-tone composer, and his main interest was in that sphere, and I learned to write in the 12-tone from him, but I never wrote music in it because that was not my language. Oscar Moravec understood my language. And from him, I really learned the craft that I needed to write music.
Glick earned his Bachelor of Music degree from the University of Toronto in 1955. His master's degree followed 3 years later. A session with Darius Milhaud at Aspen led to an invitation to study in Paris. By now, Sroll and Dorothy were married. Full of hope, they went to Paris together. Glick still had doubts about his direction. The confidence he was seeking wouldn't come from Darius Milhaud. Instead, Sroll came under the influence of two younger teachers, one a pupil of Milhaud, the other a disciple of the father of 12-tone composition, Arnold Schoenberg.
I would say that Louis Saguer and Max Deutsch, both of whom I studied with in Paris, had profound influence on me. Both of them spent a good deal of time analyzing music with me. All good teachers analyze, but both of them had in-depth, note-for-note analysis, which was extremely useful to me. Besides which, both of them encouraged me enormously. That was very, very important for me because I was very insecure.
after he came back from France and he was married, and, you know.
Sroule's brother Norman.
And, gee, there's no cash flow. Shock, surprise, you know. And so he called Lou Applebaum. Said, Lou, I need a job. Lou said, well, give me some time and let me see what I can do for you. And, you know, 6 months later, he called him back and said, you know, go down to CBC and talk to somebody there and see if you qualify and if they'll accept you. And he went down there.
And I got a job as a radio producer in 1962 after I came back from France.
$6,000 a year, which was in those days, or I guess we consider that a good beginning. And it was exciting. It was demanding. It was nerve-wracking at first, and there was a lot of work for him to do as a producer.
There was such an excitement of things happening in the world of music. We were building music in the country for the CBC. We had the idea that we were making things happen. We were giving performers an opportunity to be heard. At one particular time, I was producing music for four different recital periods weekly. It was just thrilling.
When I came back from Paris, France, and I got the job at the CBC as a radio producer, I was still very young. And I feel that those years of reading scores and working with the finest conductors and musicians from around the world and in Canada, we have such great musicians here, was a postdoctoral degree of high proportion. My reading skills, my musical skills, my formal skills, my stylistic skills all honed themselves. And it's very interesting. It helped me make the decisions about what kind of composer I wanted to be very clear.
The insecure composer who'd gone to Paris to find his voice had made another discovery. In the search for a modern, secular voice, he'd grown away from his Jewish roots.
He'd moved away from the family involvement, Jewish involvement. He wasn't concerned about keeping the traditions and all that. And then finally, when we came back from Paris and he came back and the family meant a great deal to him. And I think that being away from them made him aware of how much it meant. And then as the children came, he wanted an identity. And so he started to get involved. When, shortly after Paula was born, he was invited to be the choir conductor of the Beth Tikva. And that changed his life completely.
They had a very, very devout, focused rabbi by the name of Feder, who really got a hold of Sroule and really influenced tremendously. And he was becoming more devout and more devout. and was really brought into a very, very strict observance that none of our family really understood, especially his siblings.
I mean, that was really a big thrust towards the Jewish music. That was a place for him to belong. It was a place of recognition. He had a real relevancy there. And I think he blossomed. He started to blossom in a certain way because of that involvement. It gave him a place.
And so that took a hold of him, not only in his whole lifestyle and his beliefs, but it also took command of his music direction.
The idea of music being an expression of your soul, the idea is music being a means to communicate both to God and to man, is very, very serious for me.
I've been labeled very much a traditionalist and have felt very often guilt feelings because I should be like my colleagues and, you know, pushing along and writing avant-garde music. But because perhaps of my late start, or perhaps because of the cantorial influence, perhaps because of a personal need, I've just got to go along in this particular way until I find the right path, and then if it goes that way, okay. If not, I'll write this way the rest of my life.
I think he wrote this way all the rest of his life, but he incorporated some of that way as he went along.
I think there was a contest. He was fighting to find his voice, but on the other hand, he was fighting to stay safe at home. I think he had a little bit of a fear of stepping out and how he might be received. And you know, there's nothing worse that an artist can live with than a fear of failure. And I think he may have had a touch of that. Maybe.
In the 1960s, Glick began a lifelong juggling act. He had a full-time job as a music producer with the CBC. He was music director of Bet Tikva Synagogue. He was teaching young composers, and he was still trying to leave enough time for his own work and for his young family. So how did he keep it all together?
He was an extremely disciplined person. Why? Because he was desperate to be a composer. He wanted to be a good father, he wanted to be a good provider, but he desperately wanted to be a musician and a composer, and in order to do that, he had to be very disciplined. So he structured his life. And that was quite amazing.
Because he was a producer at CBC, he would get off awfully early. He had a soundproof room that wasn't quite soundproof. My name is Stefan Glick, I'm Cyril's son. We would hear him very early in the morning sketching, playing things over and over again, fitting them together.
I'm Paula Glick, and I'm Cyril's youngest daughter. Actually, he was the one that woke us up in the morning, but he was already up and had already been in his room composing, which was right next to my parents' bedroom, and that was his time. It was very clear that it was a time for him to be left alone. So we didn't really disturb him. And when he opened the door and came out and would make breakfast or whatever, that was it. And then he was off to work.
he was a very motivic composer. He needed, whether it be the building blocks of melody, the rhythmic blocks, he sensed he could be very creative and go off in different directions as long as there was a tremendous coherence to his work. We would often look at what constructed his melodies, the motivic qualities. It could be a three-note figure, it could be a six-note figure, but always trying to reduce it to the basic blocks of his composition, and that they shouldn't be forgotten, and that if a new theme was developed or a new aspect was the second movement or a middle movement didn't have coherence with the first one, he would put it aside.
You get an idea. The idea can be the idea of complete work. It could be the idea of a single musical motif. A da-ba-ba-bum could be a germinating idea which could give you rise to a whole symphony. An idea could be a particular harmonic structure, a particular rhythmic structure. And the growth of those ideas, for me, is an organic process. Once I have an idea, I live with it. It's a 24-hour-a-day life. The music goes on and on in my mind. And it grows. It takes seed. It sprouts roots and flowers and variations. And these variations are alive with potential. Eventually, they form themselves into a piece. Sometimes I'm walking along and an idea comes into my head. It's a gift. And very often when that happens, I say that God is speaking through me and that I accept the gift and I write it down. I think the point is inspiration is not something that comes once in a while. But as you work on a regular basis, what was an original idea that came and inspired continues to inspire. What is that? Is that inspiration? No, that's hard work. But in the end, I was inspired. It took me at least 4 months before I found the color, before I found the tone, the harmony, and the sense of the phrasing, a melodic line for the song cycle I Never Saw Another Butterfly. It was a very difficult struggle.
Chestnut candles in the cold. never saw another butterfly. That butterfly was the very last one.
I want you to know that I've had a laboratory. For 18 years, I've conducted the Beth Tikva Synagogue Choir. And for 18 years, I've had my liturgical music coming back at me. Music that I've composed and that people have sung and prayed to. Very often, it has formed the basis for Sweet Hebraics, liturgical music that I've composed for the synagogue.
Separate the music that we've just heard, the choral music, the overtly religious music, from so-called secular music, or is it all one to you?
No, it's all one. All my music is an attempt to be spiritual in one way or another. Sonata is a perfect example because at the end of it, I use a Rosh Hashanah prayer. There's a melody that goes, Adonai Melech, Adonai Malach, Adonai Imloch Leolam Vaed, which essentially means God lives, lived, and will live forever. And I introduce this at the end of the flute sonata because the flute sonata is kind of this wonderful praise of life. And how can I praise life without praising God?
I first met Cyril Irving Glick in the old CBC radio building on Jarvis Street in downtown Toronto. He was a compact man, and with his beard and his kippah, more than a bit rabbinical. It was the mid-80s, and I was a fresh CBC hire, new to Toronto, not knowing a soul. Cyril and his wife Dorothy invited me to share a Passover Seder with their family. Their hospitality was a godsend. I was familiar with Sruel's reputation, but the man I came to know wasn't the Sruel of legend, the producer of innumerable award-winning records, concert series, and radio documentaries. Now he looked hunted. He'd been demoted, assigned a rough cubicle, and delegated menial tasks. Without any humor, he told me, "They're out to get me." Sruel's brother Norman.
It was a nasty piece of business, I think, at the time. And they just wanted him out of there. You know, I mean, that was obvious. I mean, time has come. Either you walk out or we'll push you down the elevator shaft. Okay? So we certainly encouraged him to get proper legal advice and proper direction. And he negotiated if you have to go, you got to go. And he made the best deal he could, and that was it. I think he took a serious emotional hit with that firing.
Glick left the CBC in 1986. Life changed dramatically as the family recalibrated to a composer's income. A couple of years later, Glick's friend Frank Raske interviewed him for the Anthology of Canadian Music.
Let me ask you a personal question. Is it possible for a Canadian to make a decent living as a serious composer today?
Well, let's say I hope so. Right now, I'm so pleased to be able to be writing music full-time and to be able to try to raise myself up to a level where I'm writing music not for myself, not for the Jewish people, not for Canada, but for a hope in the world. It's a dream, perhaps messianic, if you will, which is part of my character and part of the structure of my people, to hope for the best for the future and to hope for that glorious time when the world will be at one. I want my music to be at one. I want my music to be able to be understood, appreciated, and loved, first of all by myself, then by my wife, and then by anybody else who can come to it.
Sroul got a good part of his wish. His music was increasingly loved, and it was well understood. The commissions began to sustain him, but the strain had already taken its toll on the family. The marriage ended, and Sroul eventually remarried. Somewhere along the way, he must have made an enemy. A series of misfortunes began with what seemed like a bungled break-in. They culminated, but didn't end, with Sroul's ghastly shooting, an event more at home on an episode of The Sopranos than the parking lot of Bet Tikva Synagogue. The composer's daughter, Paula.
A stranger came to Sroul's house, to our old house on Farnham, and broke in. This is 8 months prior to the shooting, and my dad basically was in this incredibly physical battle. Axe handle was hit him over the head and basically cut my dad's head open, and broken pottery all over the house. And they were in a lock when this man said, "Let go of the axe handle or I will kill you." And the man, dad, let go. He just, the guy's going to kill me. He let go, trusted him, and the man ran out.
The person who shot him knew what his schedule was and had timed this perfectly for that. He spent a lot of time in hospital, a lot of time immobile because his leg needed to be reconstructed. It had effect on his personality, on his psyche, I'm sure, and naturally an effect on his music.
This concert by the St. Lawrence String Quartet, presented by Music Toronto, continues now with the first performance of the Quartet No. 2 by Sroul Irving Glick. Glick says that when he began writing his second string quartet, he was taken aback at the aggressive drive, the vehemence, and the bitterness of the music that was pouring out of him. He says, "I wondered if this had any relationship to the shooting incident, which I had been involved in a year and a half earlier." Glick was shot in the leg in the parking lot of his North Toronto synagogue for reasons that have never become clear.
it started a stream of events in his life that were a downward spiral, because I think that his ultimate disease, although you can't prove it, but...
Well, yes. I mean, after the shooting, it took 4 years between the shooting and 4 years later to be diagnosed with blood and bone cancer.
Well, he didn't fall ill by accident. I mean, that was that was just a continuation of the trauma that he suffered to begin with the baseball bat and the gun. That's a killer pill to have fought himself into recognition as a composer and doing what he did is nothing short of a miracle. I don't think there was anybody who would have given him a 1,000-to-1 chance of accomplishing that.
I remember I went with him to the hospital the first time he was to take his treatment. And I remember this extraordinary look between the two of us, and I was trying to figure out, what is he saying? And finally he said, "Can you believe this is happening to me?" And I didn't know what to say, because in a certain sense, I mean, we've, you know, you just, first of all, I never expected such a thing to happen. And I always, if I ever thought of Searle, Searle's going to live forever. And so in that sense. And then the other part was, I couldn't answer, because this is life. I mean, these things happen. So there was, but it was a stunning moment where, but he never said, "Oh, woe is me. Look what's happened," at least in my experience. So he, yeah. So I think he was very brave, very brave. And he refused to take medication that would knock him out. In other words, he had to bear through a lot of pain, a lot of terrible moments, because he wanted to keep his clarity. He wanted to be able to compose, and he composed up until almost the last minute.
Searle Irving Glick died on April 17th of 2002. After a long fight with cancer. His legacy as a composer is prolific and profound. 200 liturgical works and concert works for every combination, from solo harp to full orchestra. Musicologist Robin Elliott credits Glick with achieving his greatest expressive power and emotional depths through economical means. But I think that it's in his choral works that Glick communicated most powerfully. And nowhere is this power more intense than in his choral symphony, "The Hour Has Come," with its closing lines, "Where art thou, O family of man, sisters and brothers? The hour has come to love."
I wonder, Searle, would you accept my definition of you as a universalist? I see you as a gifted man of music whose works reflect universally our laughter through the tears. Would you accept that?
I have very strong feelings about universal, because I believe that one doesn't become universal through nebulousness, but through a particular, by expressing a very strong truth about a particular thing. You teach the world about a universal thing. And I believe, therefore, that I would accept what you say, that yes, laughter through tears, but my own personal conviction that what I have to say is important for me as an individual.
What mattered to him was to be able to express what he honestly felt. And he searched for that honesty. And that is universal no matter where you belong. If you were expressing what you really are, and I think he was successful in doing that. then he belongs forever. And I hope that he is played forever and listened to forever.
If he finds one person, 10 people, 100 people that like his music, I think he will have accomplished his task. So I think he sent out a message. And there are people who are going to like it. And as time goes on, maybe it's his hope was they'll get used to it. That would be his attitude. They'll get used to it.
Just heard another in Groundswell Radio's series called Canadian Music 101, and these portraits were commissioned by the Center Discs label for a series called The Canadian Composer Portraits, and they were all produced by Etienne Cornfield. Well, that's about it for this week. You're listening to Groundswell Radio on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. To find out what's going on at Groundswell, go to gswell.ca. And as always, if you have any requests, suggestions, or ideas for the show, drop me a note, info@gswell.ca. You can also call the office, 204-943-5770. Now, we've got a bit of extra time today, so I thought I'd play a bit more music by our featured composer. We're listening to the St. Lawrence String Quartet with String Quartet No. 2 by Cyril Irving Glick. We'll have to fade out of this, so I apologize in advance. But thanks for listening to Independent Radio on CKUW and to Groundswell Radio. I'm David Scott, and I'll be back next week with a bunch more new music.
Downtown Underground, CKUW 95.9 in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada.
Homelessness is a lot like musical chairs. Except not with chairs.
When the music stops, more than a quarter of a million Canadians, many of them children, don't have a home.
But if we act right now with urgency, we can fix it.
Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca.
Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
This is David Barsamian, host and director of Alternative Radio. Alternative Radio can be heard on CKUW 95.9 FM every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Alternative Radio is committed to the principles of public broadcasting, offering a forum for voices and views often unheard in mainstream media. Like CKUW, Alternative Radio is supported by listeners just like you. Go to alternativeradio.org to find out more about our programming, audio, and transcripts. Thank you very much.